Hello, and welcome to Fast Track. My name is Will Sweetser. I'm a second-year medical student at the George Washington School of Medicine and Health Sciences and the Vice President of the Emergency Medicine Interest Group. The purpose of this podcast is to help students find out if emergency medicine is right for them and to hear from interesting speakers about their path to emergency medicine. We hope this resource and others on our website help students along their path through medical school, residency applications, and into residency. Listeners will hear from different perspectives within emergency medicine, from students to residents to attendings. This podcast is being virtually recorded with our guest speaker, Dr. Catalville. Good afternoon, Dr. Catalville. How are you?
Hey, Will. I'm well. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You are an assistant professor of emergency medicine at George Washington. You completed your medical school at GW before continuing on at GW as a resident in emergency medicine and later as an ultrasound fellow. You also completed a GW Master Teacher Leadership Development Program, and you are currently the Fellowship Director for Emergency Ultrasound. You are also the co-director for the Medical Education and Leadership Scholarly Concentration, and you oversee ultrasound training for med students and for EM residents. Anything else you want to add for your very long list of...
I'm also a mom.
Okay.
My son makes guest appearances in a lot of my teaching sessions.
Okay.
He's the ultrasound section mascot.
Will he be having a guest feature tonight, or is he off tonight?
No, he's actually off tonight. Yeah, okay. Give him the night off.
Yeah, he's got to do some work.
I ran out of chocolate, so I'm not working for free.
No. So yeah, so I think, I mean, part of our, like I said in the intro, part of the reason we were interested in having you on was kind of having a different perspective, having the background in so many different ways with the ultrasound, with your, you know, the teaching that you do with the students. You went through that leadership program and your time as a nurse before school. So I was wondering, you could probably start there with you were a critical care nurse for a number of years, and just how did you kind of move from nursing into medical school and then becoming a physician?
Sure. So I'm the first person in my family to go to college. And so for me, I knew I wanted to be a doctor, but the only thing I knew about medical school was that it was really long and really expensive. And since I was paying for it, I figured I probably should have a clear idea of what I was getting myself into. And at the time, I was at a community college. I was living with my grandparents. They gave me room and board and tons of delicious food. And there was a nursing program at my community college, and it was a two-year RN. And so it got me pretty quickly into the clinical arena.
Okay.
And I moved to Vegas, and I worked on a med-surg unit and became charge nurse, code team leader, peer educator, that kind of stuff.
Wow.
I always had more questions about like what the next step was and what we were doing and why we were doing it. And then went into the ICU, and my hospital had a specific training program. So there was like a 6 week long preceptorship and, you know, intense classes and lots of pathophysiology and anatomy. And then, you know, we did a lot of procedures at the bedside. It was a cardiothoracic ICU. And so we were doing intubations and running codes. And it was not a teaching hospital also, which provides some context, I think, for why I love critical care and why I ended up going into emergency medicine. There was no doctor in the ER or in the ICU overnight. And so if we had codes, we ran the codes ourselves, just based on ACLS protocol. And when the ER doc was not busy with the ER, then they would come in and sort of oversee the rest of the resuscitation and do intubations. We also had flight nurses that would come down and do intubations if needed. I was assisting an anesthesiologist in inserting a Swan-Ganz catheter. And for folks who are listening who don't know what that is, it's a specialized catheter that goes through a vein in the neck or the chest down into the heart to measure the pressures inside the heart. And so it involves putting in a specialized IV. There's a lot of steps to the process, but I had memorized all the steps, and I loved like watching every like thing and anticipating every next move. And I just sort of had an epiphany that I wanted to be doing the stuff as opposed to assisting with the stuff. And I always had questions about why are we giving this medication? Why are we doing this blood product? And so I had enough longevity at my job at that point in time that I could kind of make my own schedule. So I told my boss that I was going to go back to school because my associate degree didn't cover the prereqs for med school. So I enrolled to UNLV and signed up for bachelor's in biology and did the courses over 4 years. I worked in the ICU every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. And I went to school Monday through Friday for 4 years. And then
That's busy.
I came to GW.
Jeez.
It was good training for medical school, as it turns out.
Yeah. Dang.
And so I came to GW. GW felt like the right place for me. GW has always felt like home for me. Just the personality here and the temperature of the room, if you will.
Sure.
That's the foundation of it all.
Okay. And so you were kind of talking about, doing all those procedures and things in the ICU kind of got you to EM. But once you got to school, you saw the full breadth of medicine maybe in a different way. So how did you kind of narrow in on EM?
So when I started medical school, I had an inkling that I was either going to go into critical care or something procedural. Again, because I like using my hands and I like doing something and having an immediate result. And so while I went through the preclinical years were not particularly helpful for me in deciding what I wanted to do, it was helpful to actually get into the different rotations. And I think one of the things that you will find in folks that do emergency medicine is that we like everything a little bit. We don't love anything a lot except emergency medicine because it's a little bit of everything. And most of us do not like to round. Most of us do not like a very rigid and predictable schedule. I say most of us because everybody there's a spectrum of what people want and need in their lives throughout medicine. But if you end up liking a little bit of everything and you are stimulated rather than distracted by a little bit of everything and you feel like that invigorates you, then you just might be an emergency medicine doc in the tra in training. As far as like the final decision, in my fourth year, I did an ICU elective for 4 weeks, and that really helped sort of narrow it down for me because I realized that while I do really enjoy critical care, there are aspects of it that I didn't need to be a part of my daily practice. And rounding is a big part of it. That was a big part of it. But it's also, emergency medicine folks also like to see results, and there are times in critical care where your progress is slow and steady. And it's much like the tortoise and the hare. And my personality and the way I like to take care of people, it just doesn't align with that. And for folks who are super, super analytical and want to sit around and pontificate and wax philosophically about, how to replace someone's potassium phosphate, whatever, and adjust their TPN and things, then awesome. It was not my jam. I think the other thing is that what we haven't talked about is what it's like to be in the ER on a day-to-day basis. And you get the stubbed toes and the STDs and the folks that struggle with substance abuse and the folks that are experiencing homelessness and the folks that are just scared. And then you get the folks that are really, really, really sick too.
Yeah.
And I like that I almost get to do a version of primary care without having to be a primary care doctor.
Yeah, that's a big part.
Yeah. So those are my thoughts.
Okay. And you kind of, you've kind of taken the next step further with the fellowship in ultrasound. So how did you kind of, feel like you wanted to specialize with that fellowship? And then, now you've translated into the director role and you're, the point woman for teaching ultrasound from residents to students. So how did that kind of develop?
So I fell in love with ultrasound as my first rotation in residency. It was amazing to me that you could take this tool to the bedside and answer the question that the patient had coming in. Am I pregnant? Is the pregnancy where it needs to be? Do I have gallstones? Is my heart pumping properly? And I found it to be a remarkable tool for clinical decision making, but it's also another way to connect with your patients in a rather harried environment otherwise. Because I think that folks imagine emergency medicine as like, okay, you get in, get out, you get in, you get out. And a lot of what we do is rapid and algorithmic, and there is not a ton of time to connect with your patients, but excuse me, when you are able to have a conversation with your patient while you're pulling up pictures of their anatomy and you're explaining just their anatomy, just like telling them what you're seeing on the screen, it provides a significant amount of reassurance for folks. And so that was an unexpected benefit of putting ultrasound in my tool belt. I think the other thing is that I have always been excited about teaching. Even in medical school, I was, I did the Alanis Club, and when I was a fourth year, I was a talk student and the like. So I knew that education would be part of my career path as well. And so it just made sense for me to have this thing that I could specifically take beyond just teaching people how to be a doctor and how to think like an emergency medicine doctor, but also teach them a discrete skill that would enhance their clinical decision making at the bedside. And so as I have progressed through different parts of my career here at GW, opportunities have come up. Like, for example, my fellowship director started the curriculum here at GW, which integrated ultrasound into anatomy. And, we started doing it with standardized patients and doing it in parallel with the systems-based curriculum. And then when I had been doing that for quite a while, we had some new awesome faculty come into the department who had some other great ideas about what to do with that next. And so now I have taken sort of a more mentorship role in that. And my colleagues, Dr. Drake and Dr. Nachitende, are kind of the leads for medical student and resident ultrasound education.
Okay.
And then that led me to have a little bit more time to focus on the fellowship, which is, again, trying to help teach the emergency medicine ultrasonographers of the future to take on leadership roles
Yeah.
in their respective careers.
Do you feel like a maybe GW emergency medicine residency in particular, because that's what you know, or just EM residencies in general, do you feel like they train residents sufficiently in ultrasound to do most bedside, or do you really need that fellowship to gain the confidence to really do diagnostics?
So that's a great question. Emergency medicine in particular actually has ultrasound fully integrated into the curriculum and into the expectations of credentialing for someone graduating from residency. So the reasons to actually pursue an ultrasound fellowship don't really have much to do with your day-to-day operations of ultrasound in the department, because any emergency medicine doc who graduates from a fellowship in the last 15, 20 years can do a fast exam, a basic echo, find a baby, look at a gallbladder, look at an aorta, do a DVT study, do vascular access kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So the reason to pursue a fellowship is to be the person who is teaching ultrasound or administering your ultrasound program. Because the behind the scenes stuff is all of the ultrasounds that are done in our department, we review, we look at them. So I don't know if you've ever heard of the concept of an overread. Like a lot, this is over in the radiology department a lot. So we'll look at x-rays in the emergency department and say, okay, fracture, no fracture, effusion, no effusion. And then the following day, another attending radiologist will look at those images. And if they see something that we didn't see, maybe it's a nodule in the patient's chest x-ray or something, then they call us and say, hey, we saw this other thing. So you guys need to get in contact with the patient. You know, because just multiple layers of safety and what we saw, what we call quality assurance. Mm-hmm. And so we do the same thing for ultrasound. And that's not something that every emergency medicine doc does, you know, is to review all of those images. So they leave it to the folks like us who look at a million ultrasounds, not really a million, but a lot.
A lot, yeah.
To be able to sort of identify those subtle abnormalities. Because the other thing that you got to think about is, even if you're going into a room to do an ultrasound, to look at someone's gallbladder or their kidney or their liver, mm-hmm. there might be something there that you weren't looking for, but because I've looked at 1,000 kidneys, I recognize that kidney doesn't look normal.
Sure.
Right. And so then I can contact the patient and say, hey, we saw something on your ultrasound. It needs follow-up. You should see your primary care physician. Can I call them for you and sort of describe what we've seen?
Gotcha.
So that's part of it. Also, you know, being a fellowship director, being if you want to teach ultrasound on a grand scale at a medical school, you've got to have some additional training under your belt, right? And so the pillars of an ultrasound fellowship are clinical ultrasonography. So this sort of takes you beyond the basics that you learn in emergency medicine residency to sort of higher level echocardiography skills and diastology and, you know, looking for advanced nerve blocks and procedural ultrasound, things like that.
Okay.
And there's the education component. We teach our fellows how to teach, right? Because teaching in and of itself is a skill. Mm. You've got to understand how to put a curriculum together. You've got to understand how to assess whether or not your learners are actually picking up what you're laying down. You've got to be able to give feedback in a reasonable way. And you've got to translate your knowledge into digestible chunks, right? The third pillar of fellowship is the administrative side. And that's what I sort of hinted at with the quality assurance and, you know, managing machines and biomed and IT and like radiology and making sure everybody's talking to everybody appropriately and maintaining those relationships. And then the last part is research, because research is part of fellowship. And so teaching the fellows the proper research skills to put together an IRB and actually figure out how to recruit patients and how to analyze data and how to write it up and sort of contribute to the greater world of ultrasound.
Very cool. Okay. Diego, I think we're maybe pivot a little bit. In the beginning, you were mentioning your son. And so there were some of our classmates who were kind of interested in how you balance being both a parent and a doctor.
It is a work in progress. I always knew that I wanted to be a mom and I always wanted to be a doctor. And so for folks who are on the fence about whether or not you can, I'm just going to dispel any sort of misconceptions. If it's something that you want, of course you can do it. Are there challenges associated with it? Yes. Was it more challenging when he was little? Yes. Because I had Cole when I was a chief resident. So I had him halfway through my chief year. Left my other two chiefs, my co-chiefs and friends in the lurch. I was like, okay, I'm going to go have a baby now. And thankfully they were amazing and supportive and they were able to, handle all the chiefly things without any difficulty. But you know, when I started fellowship shortly thereafter, and so he was an infant. And so I had to manage my clinical shifts which meant if I worked an overnight shift, I needed a babysitter or someone to be at my house to take care of him while I was sleeping. Because you can't work all night in the ER and then take care of a baby all day and then go back to the ER to work overnight again.
No.
Right? You must sleep somewhere in there. And so recognizing that you are in fact going to have to ask for help for times like that. And when I was studying for my boards, like I needed someone to take care of him so I could study, you know, and then also sort of wrestling with the mom guilt or the parent guilt. I mean, I think it's an experience of any parent is like, does my kid know me well enough? Does my kid get enough attention with me? Do they, you know, feel like I'm a part of their life? And, you know, Cole's dad and I, we're not together. We haven't been together since Cole was a baby, but we have developed a very, collaborative co-parenting relationship over the years. And it's taken practice, and we've made mistakes, and we have done some things right. And for us, I think the thing that has helped us the most is that we try to keep Cole as the focus of things, and that, you know, trying to make sure that he has an environment which is supportive and tends to his needs at the right balance. And you know, trying to make sure that he's a respectful child and that he is thoughtful and he's empathic, and you know, nobody wants their kid to be a terror.
Right.
And so, I mean, we could do an entire podcast on parenting as a physician, and I
Yeah.
think it's different for everybody. And I think one of the things that was particularly challenging for us is that we don't have any family locally. All of our family is out west, and it wasn't an option for us to have someone come and live with us because we had a very small apartment when Cole was born. And then when we had two households that we were maintaining, you know, okay, how do you transition child care from this house to this house? And his hours tended to be more business hours versus my crazy, you know, day
Shift
shifts,
work.
evening shifts, night
Yeah.
shifts, weekends, holidays. So I'm happy to talk with anybody offline about their experiences, about their concerns. I think the types of questions that come up for different people or what people perceive the challenges might be is different for everyone.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, making sure that you have a safe space to have those conversations and know that there are a ton of doctors at GW in every single specialty who are also parents. So if parenting is something that you want to do, it's totally doable.
For
If it's
sure.
also something that you don't want to do, also totally fine. And no one should be getting up in your business about that either.
And you've been a member, or you've helped write two books, I believe, about being a parent and well as being there's a female in medicine. What was that experience like for you with those two collaboration projects?
So the first one was actually an invitation by Dean Kretschian, and it was a spin-off of the blog that she created called Mothers in Medicine. And I started contributing to the blog, I think it was in 2014. She and I had just had a lunch meeting, and we're kind of talking about medical education stuff and writing and social media. And she said, "Hey, Kat, do you like to write?" Because she knew a little bit about my story, and I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "Well, do you want to write for the blog?" I was like, "Sure." And so I wrote a couple of pieces, and she's like, "Do you want to contribute to a chapter?" And so the chapter that I contributed to was one specifically on navigating challenges as a mother in medicine. And so it was myself and two other authors. One spoke about their difficulty with infertility. And one spoke about sort of the challenge of being a single parent, divorced, and then introducing a new person into their life. And then mine was really more about my path, my sort of strange path through nursing and then into medicine, and then the challenges of, you know, having a divorce in the middle of medical school or in the middle of residency. You know, and so it was my first opportunity to share those experiences. And when I talked to Dr. Kretschian about it, it was from the perspective of life happens to everybody, right? And there's not a protective bubble that encases you when you're a doctor that says, oh, you, nothing bad's going to happen to you, or nothing challenging is going to happen to you. And right. Life is going to be shiny and happy, and you're going to have a picket fence and a dog or two dogs and a cat and, you know, live happily ever after.
Yeah, live the burbs.
And so I felt at that time, you know, I was processing my own feelings about the experience, but it was also important to me to share my experiences. The second book that came out more recently, we released it in May. That was a collaboration just of women physicians. It's not necessarily related to being a parent.
Okay.
And so it's called The Chronicles of Women in White Coats too. It's the second book in a series. And a colleague and friend of mine, who's actually a graduate of emergency medicine residency at GW, has been doing some alternative career things. She's been pursuing some consulting on the side and writing and things like that. And she'd reached out to me to ask if I would be interested in collaborating with this, with them on this book. And so I also, you know, just like everybody, I think there have been a number of challenging experiences in my life. And so this was another opportunity for me to kind of take a deep dive and share some other challenges that came up along the way and kind of what I did with those and how I processed those. And again, for me, this whole experience of trying to share a little piece of me with folks in the medical community has everything to do with the fact that I think that some of the burnout and the challenges with mental health and depression and anxiety and sort of imposter syndrome have a lot to do with this falsified sense of what things are supposed to look like.
Okay.
And what people put out there on, I mean, social media is a great example of like, okay, you only put the best stuff up on social media.
Right, right.
Or the stuff that you want to get attention for. But people don't actually really connect with where the challenges are coming in and how you work through those challenges and how you process those challenges. And while I was preparing to write this the chapters for the second book, I was having meetings with some of my students. And it was just very interesting to hear their perception of my life or their perception of me, and that they just thought everything was just so easy, and that, you know, I snapped my fingers and suddenly magic happened and I got to where I am.
Yeah.
And when I shared some of my more personal experiences, they were like, really? That happened to you? I'm like, yes. Like, so I think it's important for us to be authentic about our struggles as physicians. I mean, you could be a badass doctor and like, can I curse on this show?
You did it.
Yeah, we can edit it out if you want.
No, you're doing great.
You can be an incredible physician.
Yeah.
And you can also have a ton of stuff going on in your life. And being able to find a space, even if it's with your closest colleagues, like you don't have to do what I did. You don't have to write it on a blog and put it in a book.
Totally.
But you should find a safe space with your colleagues to share your challenges or your tough cases or a challenging interaction with a colleague or a challenging interaction with your family.
Yeah.
That's crossing over and making life a little bit more challenging in your professional world. So I'm just, I'm trying to find ways of being authentic.
That's for sure.
That's the thread.
You know, and as a leader within the residency program, I wonder if you have been an advocate for changes to the curriculum so that, you know, your residents have an opportunity and a space to do that kind of reflection. You know, I can imagine, you know, the intern seeing their first arrest or the senior, you know, being the lead on an arrest and having to work through those emotions, you know, talking to family. So like, how is the residency program and how are you advocating for your residents and your fellows to be able to find that way to be authentic, to find that peace?
I'm certainly well engaged in the residency and I've been around for a while. I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily a residency leadership because again, the hierarchy and the structure is a little bit.
Oh, okay. My apologies.
It can be a little bit confusing for folks. No, that's fine. But like the residency leadership would be considered like the residency program director, the associate program director, and the assistant program director, the residency coordinator. Now I am involved with the education section of the residency, and I'm involved in our it's called the CCC, it's the Clinical Competency Committee. I'm the chair for that, and we as a collaborative with all of the education faculty go through, you know, the metrics for the residents on how they're doing and sort of their self-perceptions of their goals and their objectives and also objective information that we're getting from evaluations and whatnot. and so I make some contributions in that light by trying to facilitate how feedback is delivered to the residents when we do these twice a year meetings. I think a way in which the residency as a whole tries to support its residents is each intern class, when they come in about halfway through intern year, they are assigned a mentor. And there's kind of a matchmaking process with regard to who people end up being mentee pairs with. And it has to do with what the resident is interested in, maybe, you know, some demographics from their background that are important to them and sort of the personalities that we know of our faculty. Because there's probably about 45 faculty in our department. And so making sure that you have a dedicated mentor-mentee relationship early on in your training is a really important part of that process. And again, having a safe space that you can go to talk about things that are concerning you. And that mentor-mentee relationship, I mean, we do some faculty development for folks and we encourage folks to reach out to their mentors at least quarterly so that we get a temperature gauge on how things are going. Because our residents move through multiple different specialties. They go to trauma, they go to ICU, they go to OB, they go to anesthesia. You know, they're all over the place. And yeah. So making sure that we're able to check in with them on a fairly regular basis. We recommend, again, at least quarterly. And, you know, for my mentees, I have the kind of relationship that we just kind of text each other and check in and, you know, and then we try to figure out a doodle where we can align the stars
in the
right way so we can get our schedules. So we can spend time together. It's been, I think, a little bit more difficult during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
But other things that the residency has tried to do is to have sort of organized happy hours, if you will, where everybody, like, I don't know, they had like a weird hat day. So everybody was wearing like a funny hat on, you know, the thing, or we have book clubs where we get together, and it's in a scheduled but not a formal setting. And I think the other thing is we do faculty development around, you know, recognizing signs of burnout. And, you know, there are residents who are not my mentees specifically who have reached out to me over the years when they've had a difficult case, or, you know, when I send them some feedback on an ultrasound that, you know, looked a little bit odd, you know, reaching back out to me and just sort of being, you know, really upset about the fact that they missed something, and, you know, just kind of reassuring them that this is a process, right? And that the reason that training is as long as it is because we're going to miss things. And again, going back to being authentic, when your resident or your trainee is really struggling with a potential mistake they made or something that they perceive as a mistake, and you know well and good based on your experience that it wasn't anything necessarily that they did wrong, it was just the way the stars were aligned that day.
Sure.
You know, sharing your own personal experiences about tough cases and tough situations and difficult conversations, and, you know, the fact that you're still here and you're still kicking and it's hard every day, you know, it's amazing and beautiful every day too. You know, it's finding that right balance.
That's awesome. So I kind of want to maybe like take a little step back from your work and your experiences and kind of thinking a little bit more about mentorship and then just women in emergency medicine. Some of our classmates were wondering like what kind of barriers exist, what barriers that women face in achieving leadership roles, like what are those barriers and how do you believe that some women can overcome those?
So that is a challenging question to lock down, because there's not just one thing that leads into that.
Okay.
I would say that by and large, one of the biggest challenges is our own sort of implicit bias, right? And our own assumptions and gender-based assumptions, race-based assumptions, whatever, about what someone should be doing and how they should be doing it. I think one of the things that I've learned in the last couple of years, and this is based on, you know, conferences that I've gone to and books that I've read, if there are any of the women in your audience looking for reading recommendations, I think the one that comes to mind the most is Women Don't Ask. And what this boils down to is they did some research that looked specifically at negotiation, just negotiation for salary. So two people, age matched, training matched, male and female, going in for the same job. Typically, males will come out of the negotiation with somewhere around 20% higher salary. All right. And it falls back on this assumption that some women have that if they work hard and they keep their head down, they will be recognized and they will be rewarded and they will be compensated appropriately. Mm-hmm. And the difference between those two people in sort of post interviews is that when the salary was put on the table, the man asked for more and the woman didn't.
I see.
That the answer to every single unasked question is no. Like, and I think that there are, again, we could do an entire podcast on this, but, you know, the things that come to mind are the fact that we think in a lot of ways that if we work hard, that we will be recognized for our hard work and we will be compensated appropriately.
Yeah.
there's also a perception that you have to do a certain amount of grunt work before you will be recognized and compensated. There's also good literature to support that women will not apply for a job unless they think that they are 95% capable of doing so and doing the job, and men will apply when they think they've got 50% of the skills required for that job.
Wow.
I think that there are also misplaced assumptions about women who choose to be parents, and that if a woman is a parent and a doctor, that she must not have the capacity or the bandwidth to handle extra administrative tasks. And this is a very personal anecdote, but have you ever seen a mother multitask or like work a calendar for
yes.
their kids and manage to get the groceries or to order the groceries for delivery? Because that's actually what I do.
Yeah.
I don't go to the grocery store hardly at all anymore because that's a lot of time that I could be spending doing other things.
Sure.
So just as women don't ask for the things that they should be valued for, mentors of women also don't ask what women want to do with their careers.
Interesting.
And so it's not just a problem. Some of the challenge is with us knowing what kind of questions to ask when it comes to your sort of academic advancement, if you're in academics. But it also has to do with some assumptions that folks make. And this is women in leadership and men in leadership, assumptions folks make about what Bob or Pat or Susie want to do with their lives based on what they perceive is going on outside of work.
Gotcha.
And so I think it's just the way to eliminate that, the way to enhance equity across the board, as far as like problem solving and solutions, is that mentorship programs, like if you're going to have an organized faculty development and mentorship program, it should be applied the same across the board, regardless of gender identity, sexual identity, race, whatever. So similar to residency, we should be like matchmaking people and giving them, you know, like a peer mentor and a seasoned mentor that's aligned with their long-term goals and aspirations. And I also think that mentorship is kind of like dating in that you have to communicate
mm-hmm.
in order to find out what you need out of the relationship. Right.
Yeah.
And then I think the other thing that, and then I'll stop because again, we could wax philosophically on this all day long, but I didn't know until about 2 years ago that there were three relationships that are really important to your advancement. Mentorship is one of them. Coaching is another. And then sponsorship is another. So mentorship is a deeply personal relationship that you have with someone. And the mentor has the mentee's long-term goals, professional development, professional growth in mind. Okay. Coaching, it can either be a paid thing or a not paid thing, but coaching is exactly what you think of when you think of like sports. It's someone who helps you talk through a problem, but you are ultimately the one that comes up with a solution. And they're there to support, but it doesn't have to be as intense a relationship. Sponsorship is when someone who has power, has influence, opens a door for opportunity for you, or sends you an email and makes a recommendation that you should apply for something that you wouldn't have even considered applying for. Because this, well, little old me, you want me, you think I could do that? And they're like, yeah, go do it right now. And so that's something, again, This is one of the beautiful things about medicine is it is a lifelong learning process and professional development. It's not just the clinical side of things, and it's not just the educational side of things. When you're thinking about professional development and advancement and growth as a human, these are the other lessons that you kind of learn along the way.
So how are you and maybe the residency program, GW, kind of translating those, like that outlook and that like philosophy and that methodology into increasing representation of women and minorities within your faculty, within your residency program? And then, you know, if you do it more broadly across the region, the nation.
So I think that if folks just pulled up the faculty webpage for our department, we're doing a pretty good job with diversity and inclusion when it comes to race and gender. I think we have a pretty diverse department with diversity of backgrounds, but also diversity of interests. Mm-hmm. For the residency specifically, we have, this year is a little bit odd again, because it's COVID. Sure. And we're trying to figure out how to navigate recruitment while being socially distant. Yeah. But we actually had a happy hour, if you will, on diversity and inclusion and sort of what we're doing to create an environment in which folks feel welcome and actually included. Because it's not just about checking a box. It's about really creating an environment in which people feel that they can truly be themselves.
Absolutely.
And, from what we do with mentorship, I mean, I think that making sure that when we have folks who come in who are coming from diverse backgrounds, that they feel truly supported and that we are engaging them and we are opening doors for them and we are creating opportunities for them. You know, for me personally, there was a point in time, I think it was about 2 years ago, I was helping to plan our Mid-Atlantic conference. And I was emailing with someone from another institution and trying to get some faculty from their institution to help with a particular session. And this person introduced all of the people in their department that we were looking to reach out to. And they signed their email. You can see her signature. It has all of her roles. And then I was like, oh, I'm holding on to too many things. I'm like, I gotta spread the love here. And that was an opportunity really for me to realize like, oh, I don't need to do this. Like, I can do this, but like, there are other people in my department. There are other people in my section that have, again, broader experiences, varied views, different viewpoints. Like, I should be like, they should give this to them. They should do this. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that's one way in which we're supporting it. It's an iterative process. And I don't know, you probably know that GW as a whole, like the clinical operations or the clinical enterprise, has started this anti-racist coalition. And we, on the Anti-Racist Coalition Steering Committee, we are literally trying to find all of the ways in which we can transform our institution as a whole into a fully inclusive environment. And that is from our EVS and administrative support staff all the way through the dean's office and the C-suite. Hmm. Like, we need to figure out what we're doing to foster positive relationships and what we're doing that is detracting from the care that we deliver to patients, from the relationships that we have with our colleagues, and from the opportunities that are missed to help people advance and grow. And again, that's going to be an iterative process, and it is a multidisciplinary undertaking that is very much in the works and in progress.
Well, that's great. So one of the other questions that kind of, you know, jumps off of that is, what was it like applying to a residency in a male-dominated field? What should female students be looking for in programs to find success in applying to EM residency programs?
I don't think that that even crossed my mind, honestly.
Okay.
I mean, if you look at the numbers, yes, emergency medicine has about 35% women compared to men. I don't know that we have any data on the non-binary folks or the trans folks. And so that's, again, another potential area for discussion and expansion of the gender roles and how to really create an inclusive environment.
Absolutely.
But I don't think that gender was even a consideration for me when I applied for emergency medicine, because I was just like, I'm going to be an ER doctor.
Yeah.
Duh. Like,
absolutely.
If you look at my history, it's kind of like, I want to do something, and then I did it.
Yeah, you found out how to do it. You just took it, took the reins.
So, I don't think I would advise anyone who was thinking about emergency medicine to really consider gender in whether or not they should apply for it. I don't think of emergency medicine in general as like an old boys club kind of situation. I think that there certainly are challenges in the practice of emergency medicine that come up for women, but it doesn't have to do with getting through the door. I think it has more to do with the day to day, you know, like, here's my urine cup. I'm like, oh, well, I'm not the nurse. When's the doctor going to be here? I'm the doctor.
And do you find those issues to pop up kind of frequently for you, or?
Oh yeah, it is daily, usually multiple times a day.
Okay.
It happens so frequently. It's just part of the deal. I think when it starts detracting from the patient's care, that's when I sort of sit down with the patient and I'm like, look, I know that this may not be what you're anticipating, but I can't do my job in taking care of you unless you actually see me as your doctor and you trust me as your doctor. Because we are a team here, but each of us on the team has a responsibility in this relationship. And so this is where we need to go from here.
Do you feel like that gets communicated pretty well, or how is that a response come from those individuals?
I mean, most of the time, I think anytime you're hitting a conflict with something, you have to figure out where the common ground is. Okay. And the common ground for patients in the emergency department is that they are sick, they're worried, they're scared, there's something wrong. And you're trying to help them solve the puzzle. And so you're going to work with them. And so finding your common ground, and this goes for any conflicts really anywhere. This is not just in the emergency department. This is just management of challenges anywhere. You have to find that common ground. And sometimes it doesn't work, but you know, sometimes I can't get an IV on somebody who, you know, ordinarily I would be able to. So it's just, you gotta roll with the punches.
That's great. Well, I think that kind of wraps up a lot of what I was kind of, you know, hoping to speak with you about. Do you have any like kind of final thoughts for the listeners before we sign off here?
I think that probably my closing thought would be that you should never be afraid to ask for help. You should never be afraid to admit when you don't know something, because, you know, the day that you think you know everything is the day you hurt somebody. Being humble and being willing to take in information from different perspectives, even when it doesn't feel like it's what you want, that's the only way to move forward.
That's great. I really appreciate that. Oh, sorry.
Deep Thoughts by Cat Ogle.
Well, I'm glad we got them down. Well, I think that's a great way to wrap. So thank you so much, Dr. Ogle, for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. And I really appreciated learning from you and kind of getting more insight to, you know, kind of how you view the world. And I hope listeners will also appreciate this conversation.
Of course.
No, thank you.
I'm delighted to partake, and thank you so much for the invitation.
Yeah, you're very, very welcome. So for the listeners, if you would like any more information about emergency medicine, please feel free to go to our website at gwuemig.com and reach out with any questions. And again, thank you so much, Dr. Ogle.